This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. What a day, what a day, what a day. We got completely schooled in the best way possible about what a comprehensive economic partnership agreement really is and how it's different from your normal free trade agreement. That was with Taufik Rahman of the Mohammed bin Rashid School of Government. He is very clever and you will be too after listening to our interview with him. Summonomics, we've been looking at the summer rise and people wanting to put their Rolex in a vault before heading to Europe or the UK. And Leshka is the managing partner from HBS Privé Vaults we've spoken to this morning. And on the back of a falling Japanese yen and a really good deal if you're going there for a holiday, Rodrigo Gonzalez, who is the director for Tokyo at the Economist Intelligence Corporate Network, has been speaking to us about what's happening to the currency and the economy.
Top story that we're covering for you this morning, the world is covering this morning, is the debate between Trump and Biden, which wrapped up when we were on air this morning, about two and a half hours ago. First of all, let's look at the economics. We're the Business Breakfast. It's what we do. This is what both of the candidates had to say. Biden, first of all, on what he's done for the economy.
We created 15,000 new jobs. We brought out the position where we have 800,000 new manufacturing jobs. There's more to be done. Working class people are still in trouble. And we're going to make sure that we reduce the price of housing.
This was Trump's response.
The only jobs he created are for illegal immigrants and bounce back jobs, a bounce back from the COVID. He has not done a good job. He's done a poor job and inflation's killing our country.
But the reaction, Tom, over the past 2.5 hours hasn't really been about their policies on whichever issue it may be. It's been about the performance, and even the left-leaning pro-Democrat media have been weighing into this one.
It's the P word, isn't it? Yeah, it is performance. And yes, we desperately want to focus on all things other people's policies, but therein is the nature of election and presidential campaigns the world over at the moment. The whole idea of a televised debate is not really to get to the nitty-gritty of economic or other policies, but it is an option for people to judge, and they judge on performance, they judge on image, they judge on a delivery. And on all three of those criteria, if you're going down that road, Joe Biden failed this morning. He appeared tired. Some analysts suggesting, you know, disoriented at times. He slurred a few of his words. He was incomprehensible at times. And it hasn't gone down well.
Well, even that soundbite we played from him earlier, just have a listen to this.
We created 15,000 new jobs.
It wasn't 15,000, it was 15 million new jobs. And it's things like that that have got not just the Republican commentators, because they've been commentating, they've been questioning Biden's performance for some time now. But it's the Democrats, Brandy, who've weighed in now, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of questions about whether Biden is the right man for the job. And I say that knowing that he is in the job.
This is Van Jones from CNN. We know CNN leans towards the Democrats. Van Jones is a Democrat. He was an advisor to Barack Obama during his administration. So he's nailed his colours firmly to the blue mast. This was Van Jones' reaction on CNN to Biden's performance.
It was painful. I love Joe Biden. I work for Joe Biden. He didn't do well at all. And he looked, you know, I'll give you the analysis. You know, you kind of have the old man versus the con man. I can walk you through how I'm supposed to see it and say it, but I just want to speak from my heart. I love that guy. That's a good man. He loves his country. He's doing the best that he can. But he had a test to meet tonight to restore confidence of the country and of the base. And he failed to do that. And I think there's a lot of people who are going to want to see him consider taking a different course now.
Consider taking a different course. Now, he's won the primaries and the caucuses to be the Democratic candidate, but we haven't had the conventions yet. And that's when formally the parties endorse their candidates. And a number of people on mainstream media like CNN or indeed social media saying it is time for the Democrats to find a different candidate, even at this late stage. What are we hearing?
Well, I'm looking at Forbes. These are the likely Democratic presidential candidates if Biden drops out. Not the only article like that at the moment. Questions about who we could see. Let me give you some names. Kamala Harris.
Okay.
Obviously. Gavin Newsom, the Californian government, a number of Democratic governors whom I have not heard of, Gretchen Whitmer from Colorado, amongst them. And the question about whether we could see a complete outsider, a third party candidate, sort of challenge Biden from the left.
Tom, what are you reading about what happens next in terms of the Democratic nomination?
The shaky performance from Biden has prompted Democratic pundits to suggest he should step down immediately, make way for a new candidate. It's too late. It's too late, and he's too powerful. And I think, you know, one of the sort of abiding features of Joe Biden, whether you see it as a positive or a negative of his character, is he's stubborn. He's a stubborn man. And I don't think he's for moving. You know, the reason that he has kept his running partner, you know, under wraps for so long. I mean, where has Kamala Harris been? Yeah. Where on earth has she been? Throughout his presidency, throughout his latest term, is I think, an indication of the man himself. I mean, we know that she had a shaky start as well, but I think it's an indication of. I genuinely think it's too late, especially given the scale of the process. We know that things take longer in the States because of the scale of the process, because of what's at hand. They just don't have the time to do that.
Well, this is Joy Reid speaking on one of the US networks, MSNBC, again, a left-leaning cable network in the United States, saying Biden was extremely weak and the Democrats are approaching panic.
The universal reaction was somewhere approaching panic. Hmm. The people who were texting with me were very concerned about President Biden seeming extremely feeble. Seeming extremely weak.
And in fact, Brandy, his team during the debate started briefing journalists, didn't they, about the fact that Biden had a cold.
Which is not what you want. You would be somewhat offended if halfway through an interview I popped up on LinkedIn that Richard hadn't had an awful lot of sleep last night.
No, it's not a good look, is it? Other stories we're looking
Mind
at...
Mind you, this is Richard. He'll tell us that himself, won't he, Tom?
But, yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong. If you had a cold, that's great. But then... come out before, what, did he develop the cold during the 90 minutes of the debate? Surely if he had a cold, then he would have known about it before.
This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Where we go from a political debate to, I don't know, a term once coined in a political debate, it's the economy, stupid, was one that Bill Clinton's team was known for in one of his presidential campaigns. We are looking at the economy this morning, but with someone who is extremely clever indeed. As the number of CEPAs that we've signed here in the UAE stack up, and the one with Georgia, the country, not the presenter, comes into being, got us wondering yesterday, what exactly is a comprehensive economic partnership agreement. Enter Taufik Rahim, who is a principal in the 2040 Advisory and a non-resident fellow at the Mohammed bin Rashid School of Government. Taufik, good morning.
Good morning and good evening from where I am, which is in New York.
Excellent. We should have had you weighing in on the presidential debate earlier. Tell us, the SEPA, what is it actually set up to do?
Well, SEPAs go far beyond FTAs or free trade agreements. They're a comprehensive economic partnership agreement that covers not just trade, but also services, government procurement, investment, other regulatory matters. So it really is comprehensive in nature. It's setting up an economic partnership between countries for modern economies of today and tomorrow. And I think that's what the UAE is establishing and in many ways is a trailblazer in what it's doing.
That's interesting because that's one of the big things that we were wondering. What is the difference between a SEPA and an FTA or a bilateral trade agreement? You say it's more modern. What do the more modern economies need?
Well, the more modern economies, you know, realize, you know, when we just talk about goods, for example, which has really been what a lot of trade agreements have been modulating and assessing, a lot of goods actually or economic, let's say, production is done through goods that don't go across borders or digital goods. They're services. And so in this way, you're covering a lot more than just, you know, physical movement. And that's where I think the UAE is headed. And there are even other conversations, you know, beyond that, that I think are occurring and will occur when it regards to, you know, blockchain or other types of financial transactions. I think we're going to see these SEPAs only, you know, expand in their nature and what they include.
Is it a one size fits all, or is each SEPA targeted for the country that we're dealing with?
Yeah, that's the challenge. You know, when you do a SEPA, it's not so straightforward because it's covering so many things. And the size of economies are different. The nature of those economies are different. When we talk about, for example, government procurement, when we talk about, you know, state-owned enterprises, or we talk about, you know, the type of goods that are involved. So it's actually quite challenging to negotiate each of these. You know, I'm a friend of the minister who's involved there, and, you know, he's spending a lot of time. This is not easy. But the fact that I think there are about 10, there are 26, you know, being, you know, discussed, it's quite an achievement. And in a world that's, you know, becoming, you could say, a little bit polarized, you're having geopolitical and geoeconomic spheres. With the UAE having all of these comprehensive relationships, it kind of becomes a node amidst a lot of division. And so trade not only is happening directly with the UAE, but is happening through the UAE for other kind of economies to be able to interact.
And the UAE is, and I've only figured this out quite recently, Taufik, don't laugh, I hadn't realised that we had effectively invented the SEPA. They are something that we made up. If you're friendly with those who are negotiating them, what do you know about the origin story?
The origins, well, you know, there's been different types of agreements over time that cover a kind of wider partnerships. And you can look at things that are called free trade agreements, not just between one country, but multiple countries. So North America, you have NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, but it also covers the movement of people. It covers also, you know, the way that natural resources move across the border. So you do have other types of comprehensive agreements, but definitely the coinage of the SEPA is novel, and the kind of nature of that being the pursuit bilaterally as the agreement of choice, that's also very novel, that what the UAE is doing.
What does it mean for other trade agreements that the UAE will already be party to? FTAs, for example, possibly through the GCC. Does the SEPA take preference?
The SEPA, you know, it's done bilaterally. Bilaterally, so it is with those, you know, countries like Turkey, for example. But it does not then supersede agreements made with other countries. But the other agreements, let's say zones that the UAE are part of, obviously globally with the WTO, that sets the floor, right? So you can't go beneath that. And so the SEPA would need to exceed that and go beyond kind of existing agreements. I think the question will become, like you rightly say, as these SEPAs grow, you're going to have a lot more intersections, and then people will need to deconflict, you know, different types of agreements. And I think that's why the UAE is starting with countries outside of the EU, you know, outside of, let's say, established zones, because it makes it easier to create kind of a SEPA on a bilateral level.
Tell me a little bit more about that, Taufik. What kind of countries does it make the most sense to sign a SEPA with?
I think it makes sense to sign a SEPA with a country that is got a sizable economy, that is growing, that is potentially in kind of a transitional state, you know, like in Indonesia, and so offers a tremendous opportunity and upside, but is able to make an agreement on its own. And so, you know, for Canada, it could pursue that. That's a great relationship for the UAE. Canada is one of the largest FDI, if not the largest in the UAE last year, with people like Brookfield, et cetera. So it makes sense. But there's a lot of things that come with that, because then you're tied with, you know, what might be harmonized rules with the US and Canada. So you're really looking for those economies where you can move and create an agreement that are sizable already. But I foresee that this becomes kind of the tool of choice, you know, going forward. And I think if you then can have the UAE saying, we have SEPAs with the majority of the world's economy, right? Then I think that's something that, you know, it would be interesting to say, right? There's $30 trillion of global trade a year. And if you could say these SEPAs cover $15 trillion plus, I think that would be something of an objective.
Does that buck what we're actually seeing around the world? We're hearing a lot more about less globalization, more friendshoring, more onshoring, more nearshoring. We're seeing a lot more right-wing governments come in elections in Europe, for example. Are we bucking the trend?
No, I actually think it's aligned with the trend. I think that's where the leadership in the UAE has been kind of had, you know, ahead of the curve. It realizes that the world is fragmented, that you can't depend on just one overarching international framework. And there is friendshoring. The great thing about the UAE is that there's friends on many sides. So what it's actually doing is friendshoring relationships to allow a wider economic corridor that the UAE is part of and in the middle of. You know, AI is a great example. That corridor that goes into Europe and the United States, you know, you saw Microsoft invest into G42, also goes into India. And so you could create, you know, a SEPA-enabled, you know, AI corridor where the UAE can play in areas where perhaps others, you know, cannot. But it's about establishing those direct bilateral ties, not depending on necessarily a global rules-based order. So in that way, it's actually aligned with the changing politics, but showing that you can respond to the changing politics and still have an inclusive, frame that encourages cooperation.
Tawfiq Rahman is a principal in the 2040 Advisory. He's a non-resident fellow at the Mohammed bin Rashid School of Government, and he joins us from New York. Thank you so much for your time.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Where, as part of our Summonomics special, we're looking at where you put the valuables, if you've got them, when you are travelling. We were speaking to the DIFC about their digital vault business yesterday. This morning, we are talking actual safe deposit boxes with a company that offers them in a couple of venues across Dubai. Hannah Lashkar is managing partner of HBS Privé Vaults. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you see over the summer for your vaults in JLT and in Business Bay?
So basically, we can see an increase of demand. We think that our clients and members are going back to Europe and they need a safe place to put their valuable, simply because what they are looking for is peace of mind. And this is what we provide at HBS Privé.
What kind of percentage uptick would you see over summer?
I would say maybe 10% increase. We work all year long, but just before summer holiday and before Christmas as well, we do have an increase.
Do you know what people are putting in the boxes?
So at HBS Privé, we really are extremely careful about confidentiality and privacy. So we do not request our client to disclose their valuable and the content of their box. However, most of our clients are using our services to put their watches, jewelry, important documents. It can be financial and high value item, but as well as sentimental items.
So what are you seeing in the rise in demand for safety boxes in general?
So basically, the rise in general, there are a couple of reasons. First of all, Dubai is a place where you have a lot of residents coming in, and you have also a lot of people traveling. Okay, although Dubai is a very safe place and a very safe jurisdiction, there's still sometimes you may have, let's say, some theft happening. It's very rare, but it can happen. So by using our service, what you have is total privacy and total peace of mind, because our facility is 24/7 secured, directly connected to the Dubai police. So it's safe and you have peace of mind.
So what rate is your business growing at? Again, if you were just to tell me year on year, what do you see?
So I would say, so we established the business in 2020. After 2 years, we opened a second facility. So as I mentioned, we have a constant growth. And during summer, we have, let's say June, July, we have an increase by 10% approximately.
Who's using them?
So we work with UA residents, non-residents, and also companies, and we have 70 different nationalities.
Which nationalities would be the highest represented?
So we would say UK first, mostly European. So UK, French, you have also Indians, Pakistani, USA. We have a large variety of nationalities working with
and
us.
What do you need to know about your customers before they can use your facilities? I mean, what kind of checks yes. you have to have?
Yes, of course. So for security reason, we do have a compliance department in our company. So we do check. So if the compliance is clear, everyone can use our services. So again, it's for UAE residents, tourists as well. So we need simply an original Emirates ID or an original passport, and corporate UAE incorporated companies can also use our services for documents.
I understand the privacy of, you know, what you put in the boxes yes. for you to know alone. But how do you make sure that no one's sticking anything dodgy in there?
Yeah, so basically that's why we have a compliance officer to make sure that the profile of the person is clear. And if we have any suspicion, we may simply cancel the contract.
And what are they checking for, your compliance department?
What they check is if there are any criminal background. That's the most important thing.
You told our producer that you'd seen an uptick in use after the flooding. Tell us about that.
Yes, exactly. So basically, our vault, so HBS Privé, we are the only vault in Dubai where we own actually the facility. So because we own the facility, we've reinforced the entire structure, made with steel reinforced concrete. And in April, there was some flood happening in the UAE, and we had an increase of demand. So maybe some people were affected by the flood, so they decided to use a third party premises like us to make sure that their valuables are safe and protected from any natural disaster.
What did they tell you about that? I mean, do you ever have conversations with people about why they're choosing to use you?
Yes, a couple of reasons. First of all, we have some of our members that they prefer to use private company rather than banks, simply because it's an extra privacy, extra confidentiality and peace of mind. I think people like the fact that we have two facilities in Dubai, one in Business Bay and one in JLT. It's a service that you need to be close to the facility. So by having multiple facilities, it's easier to reach more clients. And we offer five different sizes, including insurance of 1 million dirham. So this also gives an added value to our services.
And for a year, for those sizes, you're looking between sort of 1,000 dirhams and 10,000 dirhams, aren't you?
Absolutely, yes.
You can rent these for, I was going through your terms and conditions, which are fascinating, and you can rent, you know, you can kind of reserve a box for up to 10 years.
Absolutely.
What happens if someone stops paying, never comes back?
Ah, yes. So we cannot, it never happened because people who are using our services put something in their box. But if someone will stop paying, there's a process to request to the Dubai police to open the safe deposit box, actually. But it's a very long process. And to avoid such situation, we have invested in some technology as well. And basically, some of our members can also pre-book online or pay remotely as well. Because as I said, some of our members are not UAE residents, so they are outside of the country and maybe their contract will expire. So what we can do, they can simply renew automatically or renew even without being in the country.
Are you using physical keys or are you using like passcodes?
So we use physical keys. It's a blend. So in our facility, we have a blend of security, physical security, sorry, and technological security. But the box itself, we're using a dual key system with a master key and the key of the client, which means that we cannot open the box without those two keys simultaneously together.
What if I lost my key?
Ah, so there is no copies available in the market. So the only way to open the box, we need to use a third party company to drill the entire lock.
Does that happen?
It happens. Yes, it does. It does.
And your own expansion plans, very quickly, we've got 1 minute left yes. with you. How much bigger can you get?
So the idea is to open a third facility very soon in the UAE, and we are at the moment looking for option to expand our brand in neighborhood country in the GCC.
Which one is that?
This is a bit confidential at the moment.
Confidentiality from the private security box people. Hannah Lacha is managing partner for HBS Privé Vault. Thank you so much for joining
us
on the show this
morning.
Thank you very
much for having me. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Well, let's focus now on the Japanese economy. That, the producers assure me, is number one on the Spotify charts in Tokyo at the moment. Going to speak now to the economist Rodrigo Gonzalez, director for Tokyo at the Economist Intelligence Corporate Network. He's actually live in Singapore this morning, not Tokyo. Rodrigo, good to have you with us. Thanks for your time. So the yen, four-decade low against the dollar and, by extension, our currency, the UAE dirham. What's the story?
No surprise, really. The yen has been following this rapid depreciation since March 2022, when the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates there. So the Japan continued in this loose monetary policy, keeping interest rates at about zero. So the differential gap between interest rates is what is causing the yen to lose its value to other currencies.
So what does that mean for Japanese exports? Selfishly, here in the UAE, it's a dollar-based economy, so we care about this. We buy an awful lot of Toyotas and Sony televisions. And a lot of people have dreamed of going on holiday to Japan, a bucket list destination, but always thought, nah, it's too expensive. But maybe now is the time to go. Is this weak currency giving Japan exports of goods and services a boost?
Absolutely. You were talking a moment ago about the Nikkei rising by 1%. That is driven primarily by exporting companies. Well, Toyota is a clear example. Of course, we need to mark the difference between a healthy stock market and a healthy economy. In the case of exporters, of course, a low currency benefits them. And Nikkei or stock prices are a reflection of corporate revenues. So if those are high, of course, because sales are in dollars. So when that's converted to Japanese yen, the numbers look really good. So that's one positive outcome of the current conditions. And of course, tourism has increased considerably. Between January and May 2024, Japan saw 18 million tourists, and that trend is likely to continue.
In terms of the Japanese economy, for as long as we've been doing this program, 20 years, the buzzwords from an outsider looking in perspective of the Japanese economy have been weak growth and deflation. Is there any end in sight to that long-term trend?
It's unlikely. By our own estimates at EIU, Japan will grow by around 1% per annum until 2030. Now, bear in mind that Japan's population is declining by about 1 million people every 2 years. So all things considered, a 1% growth is, for a mature economy like Japan, is not that bad. To your second point about deflation, last year, for a moment, headline inflation was at around 4%, but this didn't mean that the healthy inflation that the Bank of Japan has been seeking for over a decade was present. That was driven primarily by rising costs internationally. Keep in mind that Japan is a net importer of energy and food. Therefore, this external pressure is what drives up inflation. But core inflation, if you remove volatility, if you remove energy and foodstuffs, that's going to come below 2%. Therefore, there is no base to suggest that the deflationary state of Japan is actually something we've left behind.
Last question from me, and again, it's UAE-centric, if you'll forgive me. The UAE has been selling energy, oil and gas to Japan for half a century now, if not more. Very big market, very important market for our hydrocarbon exports. But going forward with weak growth and the population shrinking, not growing, is that demand going to be there from Japan for these hydrocarbons from countries like the UAE?
Excellent question. Yes, I believe it will still be there. Japan produces 80% of its energy from coal and gas. Hydrocarbons, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future, will continue to generate most of Japan's large energy bills. And because of economic growth as well, rather low, the necessary investment to drive green energies, for example, there is less certainty that it is there. So it is a good bet that Japan's economy will continue to depend on imported fuel.
Thanks for your time. Really appreciate you joining us today live from Singapore. But the head of the Tokyo operations for the EIU in Tokyo, Rodrigo Gonzalez, there on the weak Japanese yen. I'm looking at what it means for hotel prices in Japan for tourists from the UAE going there. The wholly unscientific booking.com experiment, but what the heck, we like it. So what do you reckon for a really posh five-star hotel in Tokyo next Friday night? I put that date in at random. We're talking Mandarin Oriental. We're talking, you know, the Tokyo edition. So top-end hotels. What do you reckon for a room next Friday night?
Do you know what? My big question is actually, is it more or less than ours in peak season? So 11,000 dirhams.
Mandarin Oriental, 2,700. Tokyo edition, 2,400. If you want to go down a notch and go for your kind of plain vanilla five-star hotel, you can get a room at the Intercon for 1,500 dirhams, Westin 1,700, and the Sheraton 1,100 dirhams. And summer, you would say, is not maybe not absolute peak season for Tokyo, but quite peak season. Those hotels, Mandarin in addition here in Dubai, you're not getting much change out of 10 grand in peak season, are you, for a room for a night?
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.